The Institute for the Humanities at Salado presents Understanding Vietnam, Code 7-48-82, the Vietnam Syndrome, Consequences for Americans and National Policy. Speaker Philip Jalen.
We're going to move on to a larger field now in the presentation by Philip Jalen on the Vietnam Syndrome. Mr. Jalen is editor-in-residence of the Johns Hopkins Foreign Policy Institute, was editor of the editorial page of the Washington Post from 1967 until March 1978. Before joining the Washington Post, he worked from 1947 to 1967 for the Wall Street Journal, covering the Dewey, Eisenhower, and Stevenson campaigns in the White House. From 1956 to 1960, he was the Wall Street Journal's chief European correspondent in Paris and London, and he covered events in Suez, Lebanon, Berlin, and Baghdad. From 1960 to 66, he was the Wall Street Journal's diplomatic correspondent in Washington, and he traveled to Vietnam, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and Europe. Currently, Mr. Jalen is writing a syndicated twice-weekly column focusing on the diplomatic maneuvering involved in American foreign policy decisions and on the critical interaction between foreign policy, domestic policy, and politics. Mr. Jalen is the author of the book Lyndon B. Johnson and the World and numerous articles which have appeared in Foreign Policy Magazine, Atlantic, and other influential publications. He won a Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing and an Overseas Press Club citation. He is a graduate of Yale University, a member of the Gridiron Club, the Overseas Writer Association, the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Advisory Council of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. I'm honored indeed to present Mr. Philip Jalen to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I always like to point out in the thing that I send around as my curriculum, that Dewey campaign was not the admiral's, it was Tom Dewey. It's a privilege, obviously, to participate in a symposium under the auspices of this extraordinary institute and on the subject of such extraordinary importance. I am impressed by, among other things, the precision of your program. My instructions are to speak for 45 minutes. As a Philadelphian whose maternal and paternal grandfathers were both Philadelphia lawyers, this should present no genetic problem. But much of what I had to say has already been better said. When you have already heard from three professors, historian, expert on international economics, and a psychiatrist, and a general, the most you can hope for from a journalist is comic relief. I do have one other kind of bargain to offer. In my ancestry, as well as my industry, George Herring blamed the French for messing up Indochina to begin with, and Professor Rostow and others have blamed the media for messing it up at the end. And since my forefathers were French and my life's work has been in the media, if you're looking for a scapegoat, you've got a twofer. My point is, really, to get back to this subject, Vietnam Syndrome, having chosen a cliche, I should probably define it. The dictionary says a syndrome is a number of symptoms occurring together and characterizing a specific disease or condition. So a Vietnam Syndrome, presumably, is a general tendency to see in this or that situation conditions and characteristics which remind us of Vietnam. For many, this is another way of saying that they remind us of something to be avoided at all cost. But surely, the Vietnam War is not that easy to categorize. It was obviously, on balance, not good, but neither was it in all respects bad. Ronald Reagan wasn't wrong when he called it a noble cause, if by that he meant that by and large, good intentions paved the way to the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. My point is that it is not that simple to define the collection of analogies, mostly subjective, that together constitute the Vietnam syndrome. It is not always easy to distinguish between those Vietnam legacies, those effects on public opinion and on the performance of public officials, both conscious and unconscious, which inhibit useful undertakings, and those lessons which can put us on the right path or warn us away from the wrong one. We can all of us argue over which are good and which are bad. I will run down my own list and in the process offer my opinion of where, on balance, we may suffer at the hands of the so-called Vietnam syndrome and where we either have profited or might hope to profit from what we can learn from this tormenting chapter. Let me begin with those particular reflexes and responses to the Vietnam experience that seemed to me to lead us in directions which are unconstructive and unlikely to contribute to effective public policy. I would start with what appears to me to be a kind of a general, debilitating, and excessive distrust of government, of policymakers, of policy. This distrust was compounded, of course, by Watergate. But Watergate, after all, was son of Vietnam, so to speak. It derived directly from Richard Nixon's desperate efforts to deal with the crippling impact on his war effort of public dissent. This, after all, was the first purpose of the plumbers and the enemies list and the telephone taps and all the rest, to strangle dissent. You remember that line from Vietnam. It's almost part of the vernacular of the colonel describing to a group of reporters a village in ruins and saying, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. Watergate was Richard Nixon's way of saying that you had to destroy the American system in order to save it. So we can trace to Vietnam, I think, a turning away in disillusionment from Washington and all things establishmentarian. We see it in the presidents we have elected since Vietnam, in a conscious political outreach to people who have never been to Washington, except in the most casual fundraising way, people who had no clear connection one way or another with Vietnam. First, we reached out to Plains, Georgia, and when we didn't like the results, we reached out to Beverly Hills. Dean Acheson was the quintessential establishment man, but he was nonetheless a wise man, and he used to say that some awful fate seemed to condemn the United States to putting people in the White House with no real experience in foreign policy. Nixon is actually the most recent exception to that rule. Lyndon Johnson and Gerry Ford knew Washington, but even they did not claim a background or even much interest in foreign policy. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan did not even know Washington. So I think it is fair to say that there lies in their elections some vestige of the Vietnam syndrome, some reflection of a public disillusionment with the performance of those who held office in the Vietnam years that has translated itself into a general distrust of almost anybody laying claim to past experience in statescraft or in the aspect of federal government. Next comes what might be called the Vietnam syndrome. It's frequently found among those in policy-making positions today, or opinion-making positions, who supported Vietnam, who think its only failing was its failure to pursue the war flat out with whatever it took. This is, in a way, a natural political reflex, a sort of we were right the first time cast of mind among those who cannot accept the possibility that the Vietnam War established limits on American power and ability to influence events. It shows itself in many ways, including a quick rush to judgment at the first bright flicker of jingoism in American public opinion. Iran, it was said at the time of the hostage crisis, was to be, in the words of William Hyland, a former senior member of Kissinger's National Security Staff, a watershed. It closes the Vietnam syndrome. but with Hyland as with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was saying the same thing privately as Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, I suspect the wish was farther to the thought. Brzezinski said as much to me. But the wish was powerful, and it still is. It found its loudest voice in the jungle yells of Al Haig, in the confirmation hearings in the early days, in the me-Tarzan approach to foreign policy. An approach, I must say, that is shared by Ronald Reagan and his associates and followers as well. If you read the Dallas Times Herald today in a rather brilliant column, made a reference to a man called Thomas Reed, who is about the number three man in the National Security Council, and who has been making the same speech trying to explain Reagan's foreign policy. And I may say that anybody in this National Security Council who makes a speech at all is making it on good authority. It is holy writ. And he said that in his first version that when he tried to explain his basic principle, there is nothing wrong with winning, that people had likened him to Margaret Thatcher and Israel's defense minister, Ariel Sharon. Now, that's a terrible way to talk about a nice iron lady who did nothing more than blunder into a war and beat up the Argies. But even assuming that Margaret Thatcher likes the association with Sharon, I'm not certain that he's the role model that we're looking for. Of these efforts to overcompensate for Vietnam losses, one can only say they are no less helpful to coherent and realistic foreign policy than the collapse of public confidence in government. The flip side of "we were right the first time" is the quick conclusion that in just about every respect, we were wrong. From this flows an instinctive reluctance to get involved, as they say on the street, to get involved even when a superpower like the United States has the responsibility and obligation, comparable to that of a citizen watching a crime, to get involved. This instinctive shying away from the threat of the use of force, even the first hint of a potentially escalating entanglement, is as understandable as it is crippling to the pursuit of legitimate security interest. Much has been made here of the way we got in to Vietnam, of the landing of the first combat troops by Lyndon Johnson in March of 1965. We tend to forget that in April of that year, Lyndon Johnson landed, I think, 10 to 15,000 American troops a lot closer to home in the Dominican Republic. And we also tend to forget that as a consequence of their presence, Ellsworth Bunker, working for nearly a year, negotiated a settlement of that political conflict, which was a very serious one, and that we have had two peaceful democratic transfers of government in the Dominican Republic in the intervening however many 17 years. Trujilloism has been virtually eliminated from the scene. I think that we have here an example of a place where the balancing of carrot and stick had a tremendously useful effect. I can think of one other in 1958, when life was easier in Lebanon, and United States Marines landed, and within 10 days, Robert Murphy, a special envoy of the president, had negotiated an agreement which ended that crisis and gave Lebanon peace for at least another 13 years. This is really what the elusive and subtle concept of deterrence is all about. And it really doesn't work, it seems to me, unless there is some persuasive possibility that diplomacy will be reinforced by force. John Foster Dulles got himself into a lot of trouble talking about the necessary art of going to the brink, but nobody complained when John F. Kennedy did it with arguable success in the Cuban Missile Crisis. One way to measure this element of the Vietnam syndrome is simply to ask yourself what the public response would be today if the President of the United States suddenly deployed a naval blockade, an act of war, in a situation involving a comparable threat to U.S. security. I think you can find some part of the answer in the reaction that we have seen in Congress, and mostly in Congress, to the very thought originally that United States Marines might be dispatched again to Lebanon, this time in the company of French and Italian troops, merely to go to Beirut and escort PLO militiamen out of the city. Straight across the political spectrum, from Barry Goldwater to Ted Kennedy, members of Congress rose up to demand what was going on. Kennedy said of the Marines, their safety and the cooperation of all parties should be guaranteed. Richard Lugar was deeply concerned with any proposal that would put American military personnel in a situation where there is a strong likelihood they will be fired upon and would have to defend themselves. Senator Dodd said, I don't believe you can achieve the kind of assurances that I would insist upon. Congressman Jim Leach said, it's a mistake of tragic proportions. I mean, I think that's a kind of an interesting commentary on the mood of Congress and how they read the public mood. The president, of course, did not bow entirely to this. He merely assured the Congress that the United States Marines would be withdrawn if they were shot at. Now, I spent 3 years in the Marine Corps, and while it may not have been entirely my bag, that's not quite the way I was brought up. I don't wish to play the warmonger, but the Middle East is surely central to U.S. security. A successful extraction of the PLO forces from Beirut and a peaceful end to the Lebanese trauma was surely in the national interest. It was vital that the United States be in a position to offer the services of its troops to that multinational force. The French were not holding back, the Italians were not holding back, yet the first reflex in Congress from the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee was to raise serious questions about whether the president was about to violate the War Powers Resolution. This brings me to the congressional Vietnam syndrome. Now, as reflected not only in the War Powers Resolution, which rightly defines the conditions under which the president can commit American forces to a hostile environment, but also in the Clark Amendment, which says what we can and cannot do just in Angola, and in a general inclination for congressmen to elbow their way into the most intimate aspects of the conduct of diplomacy. Here again, I think we have a classic case of seeing in almost every situation where there is a prospect of involvement, those are symptoms and characteristics of a specific condition of Vietnam, sometimes where they really don't work. The practical effect of the congressional uproar over the Marines in Lebanon is a good example. Under that pressure, the administration was almost certainly too hasty in its removal of the Marines from the scene. Reluctantly, resisting, the French and Italians also left. Not long thereafter, the Israelis sanctioned the entry of Christian militia forces into Shatila and Sabra, with the horrible consequences familiar to all of us. You can't prove that nothing of the sort would have happened if the multinational force had remained, but it's a reasonable supposition. In any event, the inescapable conclusion was that the three-nation force had to return in the interest of shoring up the authority of the new Lebanese government. And yet, in all fairness, I think you hardly have to put yourself in the place of Congress. The Tonkin Resolution, of which we've heard and seen on that film a little bit, was shouted through the House and the Senate under the whip of President Johnson 18 years ago. But even those present members of Congress who were not there at the time remember that on that historic occasion, the legislative branch was out for lunch. Only a very brave few asked the right questions, and they were very readily cut off, easily cut off by assurances from the floor manager of the bill in the Senate, William Fulbright, that the president had not the slightest intention of using that authority to land combat troops for combat purposes in Vietnam. Yet the resolution they so readily accepted became the legislative justification, regularly cited by Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, for the policy of the United States in Vietnam for years to come. That is the stuff of which congressional syndromes are made. It is the stuff, I might add parenthetically, of the congressional cutback in military aid to South Vietnam in the middle of 1975, of which Professor Rostow was particularly critical. I believe he said that it really cost the South Vietnamese the war, this act by Congress. He may be right, but he also may be right that it violated a secret written agreement between Nixon and Thieu made in connection with the 1973 peace agreement. But that's just the point. This was a secret commitment from Nixon. It took a secret commitment from Nixon to Thieu to make that peace treaty, which was flawed in almost every respect, hold together. That was the chewing gum, the baling wire, the fine invisible wire that made that treaty come together. And it had to be a secret agreement. Now, why did it have to be a secret agreement? Because the president knew perfectly well that if he had come before Congress and said, in order to make this agreement work, we must commit ourselves not only to continue military aid, possibly to increase it, but conceivably to return to Vietnam. I ask any of you what the response of Congress in 1975 or 73 would have been to that proposition. It was out of the question. It reflected such ignorance of the basic flaw in his strategy, or not ignorance, but just maybe contempt. I really don't know, but I do remember that in 1975, in the period that Walt Rostow was talking about, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger was running around publicly threatening that we would return to Vietnam. We could not conceivably have returned to Vietnam under the terms of congressional legislation then in effect. It was an utterly idle boast. It could not have deterred the North Vietnamese, and still less, I think, did the cut in aid have any particular effect on their performance. And much more important, Nixon's secret letter to Thieu was certainly no way of telling the North Vietnamese, you stay where you are. I don't doubt the causal relation between what the Congress did and what the North Vietnamese then felt free to do. But I only ask you to examine the background and the context. I cannot obviously ignore the media's Vietnam syndrome. Once bitten, twice shy. There was a tendency to favor the government in those days with a certain amount of trust. What the former director of the FBI, Patrick Gray, once described as, quote, a presumption of regularity. It will come as no surprise to you that this presumption no longer exists. Here again, there is a syndrome at work, sometimes excessive. A tendency to assume the worst, to question everything, to seek out the soreheads in government, and to give them a voice. This tendency on the part of those in the news business is complemented, I might add, by a genuine change in the attitude of those engaged in the policy-making process. General Maxwell Taylor, the former ambassador to Saigon, took note of this in a recent article on the missile crisis in the Washington Post. He argued that, quote, a president today cannot count on either the privacy or the loyalty that Kennedy enjoyed. He would be dangerously exposed, Taylor said, to what Taylor called the vicious practice of leakage by government officials as a means of sabotaging a course of action of which they disapproved. Now, I don't know exactly how much of this to attribute to a Vietnam syndrome, but I think that the state of mind of policymakers is part and parcel of the collapse of confidence, the withholding of trust that is evident with the public, the Congress, and the press. It is a kind of internal disintegration of discipline, which has something to do with confidence and something to do with the fierce divisiveness engendered by Vietnam. It has something to do as well with an absence of collegiality that seems to me to have animated some of the earlier administrations that I have covered. part of it may well have to do with that turning away from professionals to amateurs, from the old boy network of the Eastern establishment to new players with no reverence for the older traditions. The difference is more quantitative probably than qualitative. Great issues of policy have always been aired by calculated leaks. Things are probably actually better today with the quietly methodical George Shultz having replaced the mindlessly combative Al Haig. But the new generation of journalists, and some of us old enough to have participated in the Vietnam experience, cannot forget that for a considerable period, the media too easily accepted the government line, and that an awful lot of the time, the government line was at its, to put it politely, misleading. Well, where else do we find symptoms of this so-called syndrome? I suspect it's to be found in the fact that nearly 500,000 young men in this country have defied the law requiring them simply to register for the draft. This is not like the 1960s protest. Over 90% of those eligible today have registered. But it says something, it seems to me, about a lingering anti-war, anti-military service sentiment on the part of young people. And it says even more when you consider that all they're being asked to do is register. When you consider that we are almost alone, with the exception of the British, among the nations of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in not requiring conscription, that we are making do with a volunteer army that in no way reflects a cross-section of our society, that not even the great communicator with his ambitious plans for rapid deployment forces dares suggest that the burden of manning those forces be shared not just among those willing to volunteer their services, but among all those able-bodied young men who are eligible. You could also, I think, include the nuclear freeze movement as a product of what might be called the consciousness-raising effect of Vietnam. There are about 9 freeze propositions, I think, on the ballots next Tuesday. I don't know how they'll fare, but to the extent that they fare well, that I think this cannot help but concentrate the attention of Congress as they approach the defense budget. As you may have noticed, the Vietnam syndrome's cut two ways. For some, it has an inhibiting, restraining effect, for they see the war as a calamity caused in large part by an overambitious, overly militant approach to the world. For others, Vietnam is merely an example of doing the right things the wrong way, and therefore an argument for a bigger, better-equipped U.S. Defense Force, committed to act not by graduated response in a limited war and creeping escalation, but by fighting to win. These tensions, these entirely contradictory readings of Vietnam, constitute, to my mind, the final element of the syndrome, continuing conflict and confusion over what the war was all about. The overhanging question marks are why we are here, and they are nowhere better illustrated than in the struggle we have been witnessing in Washington over the design of a Vietnam War memorial. As a member of the advisory board for that memorial, I have watched that project from the beginning. It is a metaphor on the war itself. The small group of veterans that started it, led by Jan Scruggs, an ex-infantryman who was wounded in Vietnam, symbolizes the extraordinary quality of those who call themselves the survivors. They wound up quarreling heatedly over the design and the very nature of the monument, but they wound up reconciling their differences in a way that precisely defines the two faces of the Vietnam syndrome. You are, of course, familiar with the story, with the contest won by the young Yale University architectural student, with the protest over its stark and muted statement. It's a V-shaped black marble wall sunk below ground level and bearing the names of those who were killed. To this has now been added a rather more conventional statue of 3 members of the armed services and an American flag. It doesn't really aesthetically fit all together, but yet it somehow strikes me as exactly the right way to solve an almost insoluble problem. It is a monument to dichotomy. It is, that is to say, an important statement in the form that was finally agreed to. It invites, it very nearly commands, a continuing questioning about Vietnam a continuing quest for the right lessons. It commands us to test our foreign policy regularly against the Vietnam experience. Most of what I have said so far has dealt with what I would consider to be the least constructive aspects of this testing.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over and continue on side two.